For the National Endowment for the Arts, this is Artworks. I'm Josephine Reed. The Arts Endowment has just announced its 2023 NEA Jazz Masters, and they are, drumroll please, musicians Regina Carter, Kenny Garrett, and Lewis Hayes, as well as Sue Mingus, who's receiving the award for jazz advocacy. They'll be celebrated at a public concert on April 1st, 2023, in Washington, D.C., in collaboration with the Kennedy Center. And you'll be hearing from them on this podcast as the concert approaches. But I'm going to begin my celebrating now by revisiting my interview with a 2021 jazz master, the groundbreaking composer, musician, and bandleader, Henry Threadgill. A multi-instrumentalist who focused on the alto sax, clarinet, and later the flute, Threadgill was 19 when he met NEA jazz master, Muhal Richard Abrams. He played in Abrams' experimental band, which evolved into the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians, or AACM, a highly influential collective of musicians. Henry Threadgill went on to explore the edges of improvisation with trios and ensembles of varying sizes, composing new work and experimenting with instrumentation by including instruments like cello, tuba, and multiple guitars to play his complicated compositions. In fact, Henry Threadgill received an NEA Jazz Composition Fellowship in 1974 and certainly went on to receive any number of awards, including the 2016 Pulitzer Prize for Music for his album In for a Penny, In for a Pound. Born on the south side of Chicago, Henry Threadgill came up in a musically varied world where the sounds of gospel, blues, and marching bands all blended comfortably together. And that's where I began our 2021 conversation, by asking him about his earliest musical influences.
Well, there was no television. Radio had all the music that you were going to hear inside the house, wherever you live. The only music that you heard outside was if you went to a church or you were standing at a parade. I can remember music from the time I was 3 years old listening to the radio. And that music was classical European music, it was Serbian music because the largest Serbian community is in Chicago, and it was Polish music because also that's the largest Polish community. And then you had, you know, rhythm and blues and jazz and gospel music on the radio. So that was something that I would listen to on a daily basis. This was before I started grammar school. And then I would hear music at my two different grandmother's churches. One church was a Baptist church, and this was a very sophisticated choir that read music and sang a lot of anthems. And it was the church that my father's mother belonged to. My other grandmother, my mother's mother, that's where the music I loved the most. This was the Church of God in Christ. They had a singing minister there named Singing Sammy Lewis. He was a minister and he sang. And it was something about singing ministers. It was something about them. Their ability to deliver words and song was exceptional. So I was influenced and captured by all these things when I was 3 and 4 years old.
And when did you begin to play an instrument yourself? And what was it?
The first instrument I played was the piano. I started playing the piano when I was about 3 and a half years old. What happened was this. The music that was famous at that time was Boogie Woogie. Me, Lux Lewis, Albert Ammons, this was the music that was being played all across America. It was kind of like Scott Joplin's music, kind of like Rags in a way. Boogie Woogie took over. And I heard that music on the radio, and I didn't even know that there was a piano in the house until that music came on the radio. I discovered this piano in the hallway, and I would sit at the piano all day with the radio on, waiting for that music to come on. I started to learn how to play that music. I taught myself to play the piano by sitting and waiting every day for Boogie Woogie to be played. My hands were so small at that time, I was very frustrated. I remember I used to be very upset. That was the beginning of my whole musical life. I learned how to play boogie-woogie when I was about three and a half years old. Later, when I was in grammar school and I began to take lessons, I wasn't very happy with the music teacher I had at that time. So I really didn't pay much attention. I would still play at the piano on my own. When I graduated from grammar school, I went to Englewood High School. The first concert, jazz concert I went to was at the high school. My best friend played trumpet, and I would begin to play tenor saxophone. And he told me that there was going to be a concert on a Tuesday night and that we should go and hear it. I went to that concert, and it was Stan Getz. I think it was Chet Baker. It was about 25 cents to go hear Stan Getz at my high school on a Tuesday night. So by the time I got to my second year, I was playing the tenor saxophone.
You said when you first heard Charlie Parker, he opened a door for you. What did you hear, and how did that door open?
When I first heard Charlie Parker, yes, a door did open, the door to improvised music. I heard improvised music in a different way. Let me back up before Charlie Parker. My influence in terms of music was blues. Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf, Jimmy Reed, this is what the music that I grew up on, and this was the music that had the most impact in my life. I don't know of anyone that had more impact on me than Howlin' Wolf. Then gospel music was born in Chicago. I grew up on this music. Mahalia Jackson is in Chicago. I heard her sing live I don't know how many times. And I heard Clay Evans and James Cleveland and all of these other great singers. But that music was not a improvised music. Of course, they had some variations that they would execute in this music, but Charlie Parker had stretched the boundaries. The music I'd heard prior to Charlie Parker, the swing era music, it just had not opened up to that complex degree. That's why I said when I heard Charlie Parker, a door opened, it opened up your ears as to what can you actually hear and what can you actually do.
When did you meet Mujal Richard Abrams?
Well, I graduated from high school in 1962 and went to Wilson Junior College. This was a liberal arts two-year college, and they had an incredible music department. All of the art departments were incredible, and the place was just loaded. The school was loaded with artists. I just can't begin to tell you. Jack DeJohnette, Roscoe Mitchell, Joseph Jarman, Mellencamp Favors, Eddie Harris, Bunky Green. This was just some of the people that were there. And we had a music club. We were charged with putting up different concerts. We would have classical concerts and we would have jazz concerts. And I don't know who it was. It could have been Mellencamp Favors that suggested getting Mujal to play, but I didn't know Mujal at that time. So he came with a quintet, and that's when I met him. We talked after the concert, and he invited me to come to the experimental band, which was rehearsing at that time at a place called CNC's Lounge. This is where the experimental band started. This is the prelude to the AACM, Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians. So I went there and played for a bit, and then he told me I could bring in some music. I brought in some music. It was a very short period because it was in 1966 at this point, and I had gotten drafted at this point, so I left. Right before I left, the AACM had been on its way to being formed.
You were drafted into the Army. Is that what happened?
I wasn't exactly drafted. I was working at the University of Chicago Hospital trying to make some money so that I could go to the American Conservatory of Music in the fall. And I was going to school part-time, which was not allowed. If you didn't have a full course, then you didn't have a student deferment. The draft board in my neighborhood called me up, told me to come down. I said, Mr. Tregill, I got good news and bad news. I said, what do you mean by that? He said, you've been caught working and not going to school full time, so they're about to draft you. He said, they haven't, but they're getting ready to draft you because they discovered that you weren't in school. So he said, what you can do is this. He said, you're a professional musician. I said, I guess so. He said, well, join the draft as a professional musician, just like doctors, all other professional people. I said, what does that mean? He said, a doctor can only practice medicine. A musician can only practice music. If you join a draft, then that's the only thing you can do in the service. And if they violate that, they have to discharge you with an honorable discharge. I said, okay. He said, the only thing is you'll have to stay 1 year longer. But draft was 2 years. He said, that means that you would have to be in there for 3 years. He said, but that can be adjusted too. If any musical organization or institution call for your services, you can do 2.5 years. And that's when the ACM wrote while I was still in the service and said that they wanted me to come and teach at the school, so I was only in the service for 2.5 years.
I think the AACM is such an important organization in modern music. I'd like you to talk about the vision that propelled the AACM and the philosophy that knitted all of you together.
It was really Mujal's singular vision concerning writing your own music and presenting your own music and developing and studying music, not jazz. The agenda was music. He believed deeply in that, and we all picked that up. You can't really say there was such a thing as an AACM school. Each one of us was schooling our own. We had our different ideas and different approaches. And it required a great deal of discipline in terms of the concept of democracy. Let me tell you what I mean by that. To completely serve another person and to keep your ideas off the table, not to critique, to be completely at their service, regardless of what they ask you to do. The idea is to let those people realize whatever their concepts are without any interference from anyone and interjected any kind of critiques whatsoever. Our job was to serve one another 100%. That was the basis of everything.
You know, what I find just so extraordinary about the AACM is that, well, so many things, but originality, personal vision was really stressed, but so was respect for other traditions and having a grounding in so many other musics. And that's really been a constant for you throughout your career.
You're absolutely right. The idea that all music from humanity is really what we were looking at. And one great thing at the time, Chicago was so rich in terms of the blues and gospel music. We had that. And the other thing that we had at the same time was the University of Chicago Contemporary Players Orchestra. They played the most advanced and the most difficult contemporary music from America and Europe. This is where I first heard and met Verez, Paul Hindemith. Oh, I can't even think. I met a number of great composers at these. We actually worked 2 or 3 blocks apart in the same area of the city. The first time I had heard the live recording of Pierre Lenoir by Schoenberg, I heard it there. The first electronic music I heard was there, that I heard Verez's electronique piece, I heard that there. And then the Chicago Symphony under Fritz Reiner. At that time, when I was studying conducting in college, and Fritz Reiner was playing some very interesting music, and Martin Nunn, who followed him, had an extremely contemporary repertoire. And it was under Martin Nunn that he actually commissioned Mujal to write a piece for the symphony, and he had something like 10 saxophones in the orchestra.
This period in Chicago was crazy, because wasn't Sun Ra playing then, too?
I started going to Sun Ra's rehearsal before. When I was about 15 years old, I guess, something like that, Sun Ra was rehearsing in the neighborhood right where I lived, in Inglewood. He rehearsed in the back of a meat market which sold wild game. So there was raccoons and bears.
Are you kidding?
And possums hanging from the ceiling. No, I'm not. No, it was a Greek wild game market. And the owner of it liked Sun Ra's music. And so at night, in the back of the market, he would let Sun Ra rehearse in the back of the market, and it was extremely cold back there. That was the only downside. I used to go there with my friend just about two or three nights a week and sit there and listen to him rehearse and try to follow the music.
As we said, AACM, that approach to music, it's finding your voice and a personal vision. And I'm wondering what that process was like for you, a finding a voice. I mean, it's one thing to just say it, but then you have to trust your voice, develop that voice, learn to express it.
Yes, that's true. The finding a voice, you know, the Midwest, Chicago, it was not New York, the fast pace of New York, and New York is the marketplace. You go to New York with a finished product. It's hard to go to New York and start putting groups together. You know, that takes a lot of time and energy. So we had time on our hands. And it was a cheaper way of living, too. We didn't pay so much. So we had time, and we took advantage of it. I tried different things. I tried all kinds of combinations of groups before I got to AIR, the trio AIR, which everything started. By Steve McCall and Fred Hopkins, and then my whole life changed. Steve had come back from Paris because, remember in the 60s, Paris was it. New York was not it. The music world was in Paris. Everybody was in Paris. The track back in the 70s, there was a change. People started to return from Paris. New York all of a sudden became a new migration center. New York got re-energized. So we came in about 70, I think 74, I think 75. 75, AIR. We played a concert. It was a January, February, and it was really cold, and it was a lot of snow. It looked like Chicago. The snow was up to your knees. And we played at La Mama Annex, and some people said, nobody's coming to hear you all because nobody ever heard of this, you all, people from Chicago named AIR. We said, so it's okay, we're going to play anyway. It was cold in the place. They didn't have any heat. We had three nights, Friday, Saturday, Sunday night in this place. The people that came Friday night, they went out and spread the word. Saturday night, it was a line down the street. And Sunday night, it was a line down the street. Some of the people, kind of like philanthropist type of supporters, came in and heard us. And next thing you know, we were playing at Carnegie Hall in April. That's how fast things turned around.
That's amazing. I know you have said you don't like the word jazz and you don't consider yourself a jazz musician anymore. Can you explain why and what your thinking is about that?
The word jazz has been abused and misused. That's why I don't like it. It's become like a pot that people throw everything in. It's lost its distinction, you know. Just put it up, something, put that over there, you know, soft jazz, hard jazz, you know, this kind of jazz, that jazz. So that's why I don't like it. And that's why I don't use it. I prefer the word creative music, creative improvised music. And I would say improvised music.
You've also said that live music is the way to hear music, and you never made a record with the Society Situation Dance Band. It was only, you only performed live with them.
I never wanted to make a record with that. I grew up going to dances when I was a kid, right? And there would be live music. Great bands would be playing. We'd go to dances and so on. I didn't want to record this. This was just for people to react to it and dance. I didn't want to get self-conscious of studios have a way of becoming self-conscious, you know, and you don't have an audience. How do you go into a studio and play dance music and there's nobody dancing? You know what I mean? You can't even tell if you're doing a good job.
Your work encompasses such a wide range of music, with a wide range of compositional techniques and a wide range of groups. You've had many groups throughout your career.
I'm going to just give a little quick overview history of the groups that I've had. The first group I had was AIR. AIR, the compositional techniques that I was developing were mostly in a major minor world and a chromatic world. Chromatic world sometimes sound like you're doing something that's free. And I never did play free music. After that, I came to sextet, and I was still doing writing music in the same kind of way, and I also had a second group that I never recorded, which was a great group called the Wind String Ensemble. That was tuba, cello, violin, viola, and I played alto and flute. Now, the sextet, which I thought of as a reduced orchestra, it had a wind section, a brass section, a string section, and a percussion section. That's how I thought of it. The percussion section had two drummers. I considered it one part. It just had two people playing different things, the way you would have in an orchestra. It would be one person on a snare drum, another person would be on timpani, another person would be on tambourine. You could have four people playing. It's still one part. It's the percussion part. Then I had the strings, which was the cello and bass, and then the trombone and the trumpet with the brass, and then I covered the reeds. But the music I was writing at that time was still within the major minor system of music, you know, major scales, minor scales, and combinations thereof. After that group came Very Very Circus, again, I was still stretching the boundaries of the major minor system. And then when I got to Make a Move, I got into as far as I could actually go in terms of this major minor idea. And it's in this period that I made major discoveries about new ways to write music, and that led to the group Zooit and the system of music that started with Make a Move, but it became, I worked everything out with Zooit. So every group that I had, it had something to do with how far I had made it compositionally. I would change groups because the compositional ideas had changed. When I'd got everything I could out of something, then I would change. I would never just change for novelty. I'd never even thought of doing anything like that. After I completely exhausted the orchestrational and compositional techniques that involved that particular ensemble, then I would start to move to the next level. And I've been fortunate that I could do that, that I saw something beyond the horizon to move to.
You mentioned Zooit, and you've been playing how long? For what, 18 years?
Oh, 50, at least 15, 16 years now.
How did that band start, and what were you looking for?
Well, first thing was I was looking for the players because I knew what the instruments I was hearing. So Tariq Benbrahim, the oud player who is now in Morocco, he's a filmmaker, also a great filmmaker. Jose Davila, the trombonist, tuba player. He had been with me in Very Very Circus and other configurations, and a guitar player, Liberty Allman. Liberty Allman recommended Elliot Cave, the drummer, with us. The first Zooit record was Daphnis Pip from Cuba. He was the first drummer with us, and then I found Elliot. Dana Leon, the trombone and cello player, great artist. So I had cello, guitar, and oud as a string section, and tuba, drums, and myself. That was the sound I was after. So we rehearsed for 1 year in New York City before we played. These people had to learn a new language because, see, I had come up with another musical language. And it wasn't just you could just come in and read this music. You had to understand the language. We spent a year learning the language and how to work with it because we had to improvise in this language. And after a year, we a little over a year and something, we played our first engagement somewhere. I don't even remember the first place. But these were special people. I don't know how many people would have stayed with me for over a year just rehearsing, but not even the idea, not the promise of recording, not the promise of playing a concert or anything.
Again, you're very deliberate in the way you create your compositions. So you create a composition that has room for the musicians you play with to improvise within that structure, that musical structure that you create. Is that a fair way of saying it?
That's correct. Yeah. There's room for improvisation, yeah. Most of the time, the music appears more seamless. So a lot of times you can't tell whether we're improvising or reading music. It's a greater ideal is to go for something like that, something that's more seamless.
When you're composing, do you find yourself consumed by it as you're working on it, or do you leave it aside for a while, walk away, maybe leave it for a week, a month, and then come back to it? I'm curious how that works with you.
Composing is like, it's like going back to square one every time. And you don't know what it's going to be. You accomplish something and you say, oh, wow, that was a nice step that I pulled back there, that step A and B. I think I'll try that the next time. Next time, there's no room for A and B. There's no place to execute A and B. So every time it's a new experience. And the music, see, the composition starts to dictate. You, the composer and writer, you have control, but you only have so much control. You know, you ever heard a writer, I'm talking about a literary writer, say that, like, they created this character, now the character is in charge. You ever heard a writer say that?
Yes, definitely.
The same thing happens with the music. You have to let the music go where it's going. Stop trying to control it sometimes. I never know quite what it's going to be. And sometimes you, like you said, I leave things intentionally so that I can get a fresh look at it, because it does get consuming. And sometimes you just need to step back.
And I'm assuming you're hearing this in your head as you're composing.
Yeah.
When you go and you were actually giving the music to the musicians, does it happen that you think, oh, that sounded very differently in my head? This isn't quite working when I'm hearing the musicians do it?
You know, my philosophy is this, for one thing. The object for me is to make music. So I write it down, I bring it in, and somebody make a mistake, I say, oh, that's wonderful. Let me change this and put the mistake in. Because that's the object for me. I'm not stuck on what I did. Remember, music means nothing until you lift it up off the paper. It has no meaning. That's what a conductor is doing. When the conductor is standing up there with the score in front of it and the orchestra, I don't care whose music it is, Wagner, Beethoven's, what the conductor is doing is saying, too many violins is playing right there. Let me have less second violins. Trumpet stop doubling so-and-so over there. He's basically saying a half a teaspoon of salt and 2 teaspoons of pepper. The composition said a whole teaspoon of salt and 3 teaspoons of pepper. That's what's on the paper. But when you start to lift it up, you find out it won't bake.
And is that what you mean when you said artistic process and product are inseparable?
Yes. Yes, it's exactly, yeah. The process. You have to find out, you imagine something. You write a script, and the writer, he sits in the audience, and it's, actors come on stage, and he laughs at this comedic lines. Well, he wrote it, didn't he? So, but nobody else is laughing. So you have to really look around and see if it's working. You got to put it up, you know. You have to play it live. That's the other thing about live music, live art. You have to resurrect it to find out, will it stand? It has to be put up. And also, the impact. You know, I listened to records with a kid, but when I used to stand up as a kid in front of Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters, it was nothing like that. I wouldn't even be in time anymore. I'd be standing there, it'd be just like I was walking through some portal or something.
It's a nice way of putting it. You've spent a lot of time in India, in Caracas, and traveling throughout the world. And obviously, all these places have different musical rhythms. And I wonder, about immersing yourself in those cultures and the influence that has on your work.
You know, it's almost impossible for me to quantify in any kind of way what I learned from different cultures. When we say music, music is a part of some culture. And if you emulate on the surface certain music, it becomes obvious that you're just like pandering to something or trying to just doing something that's so obviously not very serious. Like you said, in places like India and stuff, I mean, I listen to music there, but it's not just listening to music. It's the way people walk. It's the rhythm of the language. It's the spices in the food. It's all of those things. All of those things is what inform your creative process, not just the obviousness of like Indian classical music or something. No, it's far more than that. I think, you know, in dance, theater, all of these different mediums, we learn from other parts of humanity on the globe. As you reach out, you get a bigger reward the further you reach out.
Well, as listeners, we get big rewards, too, from the work that comes out of it. And you've received so many awards. I can't even begin to mention all of them, but I do want to mention two. And one was the 2016 Pulitzer Prize in Music. Congratulations. I know you don't like to call yourself a jazz musician, but you're the third living jazz musician to receive that. And it was for In for a Penny, In for a Pound, which you recorded with Zooid. That had to have been really gratifying for you.
Oh, it was. It certainly was. I mean, you know, I wasn't expecting it. I remember that the record company had asked my copyist for the score and an audio file on it, but that had been like a year back, and I just like, I didn't think about it. When they called me up, matter of fact, it was the record company called me and was telling me to say, you know, you won the Pulitzer Prize. I said, for what? Did I do something right or did I do something wrong? You know, it was really really something, you know. It's a level of recognition for what you do. There's no words for it. It's really great, great honor. That honor and the honors of being the Harlem stage and the Walker Arts Center where to have your work perform, where the musicians came and played all my work to honor me. That's another great honor. When people in your time play your music, then you figure you must be doing something right.
Well, you really must be doing something right because you have been named a 2021 NEA Jazz Master. And I wonder if you can say what that means for you.
Well, this honor is the highest honor that the country gives. The honor is not just to me. I didn't get here on my own. All of these people that's been in my life, all of the influences, so much I've learned, I can't even articulate and give all of the names of all of the teachers, friends, parents, and even silent supporters. That's who's standing here, that's sitting here taking this award with me. It's not just an award to Henry Threadgill. It's that part of this community in this country that produced and nurtured Henry Threadgill is why I got that award. That's what that award means. It means that you're saying something about not just me, but all those people that did something to make this a better place for everybody in this country through art.
And I think that is a great place to leave it. Henry, many congratulations. And thank you for years of your beautiful, wonderful work.
Thank you, thank Joe. You. My pleasure.
That was 2021 NEA Jazz Master, composer and instrumentalist Henry Threadgill. Once again, the NEA just named its 2023 Jazz Masters. They are Regina Carter, Kenny Garrett, Lewis Hayes, and Sue Mingus. You can find their bios at arts.gov, and I'll be speaking with them as the April 1st celebration approaches. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts. And then leave us a rating on Apple, because it does help people to find us. I'm Josephine Reed. Thanks for listening.